And good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. My name is Andrew Geller, and we're going to once again talk global warming and climate change today. And the reason is that the Conference of the Parties number 11, as it relates to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, that meeting opened Monday up in Montreal and runs through December 9th. And there's a lot of talk about what's going to happen following the expiration of the Kyoto Protocol's active period of 2008 to 2012. There's also another conference happening, and that's the meeting of the parties of the Kyoto Protocol. Those are for signatories to the protocol only. Neither the United States or Australia are allowed in that meeting as participants. They have observer status only. So we're going to be talking about that somewhat more later in the program. We'll have footage, live coverage from Montreal. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Glenn Berry. He is the president and founder of Ecological Internet, which runs many websites. Primary among them for this show would be the climatearc.org climate change portal, which I have enjoyed for many, many years and find it very, very useful. So with that, welcome back to our airwaves, Glenn.
Thank you very much, Andy. I'm very pleased to be with you and the Portland listeners this morning.
Well, cool. So for the first chunk of the program, I want to talk more generally about some recent developments as it relates to both global warming and climate change, and then kind of filter towards what's going on in Montreal, and then we'll actually talk with Kurt Davies from Greenpeace USA, who is there on site, and we'll see who else he brings along. He said he was going to bring someone else. But first, the scientific research related to climate change obviously is unending, and it continues to pile up what appears to be extremely solid evidence that not only are both climate change and global warming real and caused by humans, but the pace at which it's occurring is speeding up. Can you talk a little bit about some of what's recently been discovered to support those ideas?
Well, absolutely. Well, let me first just say, as I look out on the Wisconsin landscape this afternoon, that it's about 10 or 15 degrees warmer than it usually is at this time of year. So anyone that needs to have validation on climate change just needs to step outside and look at the phenology of trees and temperatures. And so it's, you know, yes, there's lots of science, but I think we all need to trust our ecological intuition as well. And I would say that most certainly the climate change science is rock solid. There is no doubt. There has been no doubt for years. And now people are amazed as the predictions of more severe storms and more severe droughts and melting glacier ice and all of these things are happening just as they were predicted. I think now what's really terrifying is the potential that this change may be more abrupt and really surpass the ability of the ecosystems to adjust to the speed of the change, and we could have some very nasty repercussions do we not stabilize and reduce carbon dioxide emissions by many, many times.
Yeah, I believe that the United Nations, maybe I guess it was the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which puts a report out every few years, and I believe the next update is, I think, 2007. They recommended, I forget exactly when, but it's many years ago, back in the 1990s sometime, that emissions of greenhouse gases needed to be reduced at minimum by 60%, preferably 80%. The Kyoto Protocol, for those 150 or so countries that signed it, mandate an average reduction of 5.2%, I think it is, and there's some variation, you know, for some countries it goes up to 9 or 10, in some countries it's 3 or 4.
So certainly Kyoto is a tepid preliminary step at best.
And it just amazes me that there are entities, kind of lead among them the United States government, that says 5% reduction, well, that's too much, except for the fact that in terms of the biology and the atmospheric dynamics, it's not even remotely close to enough.
Absolutely. You know, so we're talking the recent scientific findings. I mean, every week there's a new major study out. Just in the past 2 weeks, the two major findings were that the ocean level is rising at twice the rate as previously thought in the last 150 years, at 2 millimeters a year, and that they got the largest time frame on ice cores ever, and know with certainty that back to 650,000 BC, that there has never been more carbon dioxide than there is now in the atmosphere.
Yeah, and that's actually Edward Brooke down at Oregon State University in Corvallis, and he would have been on the show, except he's, I think, in Montreal attending a meeting at the moment.
Along with a lot of other climate change people.
Right, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the mixed blessing of trying to do coverage of these large events, is some of the best people to get can be at them and just wholly unavailable.
Well, Andrew, let me review just really quickly for your readers what angle I come at this from.
Okay, please.
So I do have very large portal sites on the Internet, the largest of which is climatearc.org, climateearc.org. And there what we do is we track daily all of the happenings in science and policy and activism related to climate change. And then my organization, Ecological Internet, also provides search engines and blogging and just a real sense of community and action around a commitment to, just as you led off with, reduce emissions by 50 to 70% by about mid-century, 2050. This is going to require a major commitment to renewable energy. It's going to require tremendous energy conservation advances, and it's also going to mean stopping deforestation. And as you may know, that's also one of my specialties. I sort of got into climate from the realm of forest conservation advocacy, and have a very large website, forest.org, on that topic as well. And so there's some interesting advances in coupling forest conservation with climate as well that I'd hope to comment on.
Well, and that's actually an approach that many advocate, the not only the preservation of existing rainforests, and that is something that the island nation of Papua New Guinea has suggested in Montreal, that countries that have intact rainforest, I assume above a certain size, actually be compensated for their preservation by countries that either don't have rainforest of their own, or have excess emissions. And this kind of gets into the notion of carbon emission trading, although it seems like it's a slightly different concept.
I think that they're hoping to actually make it, commoditized and traded. So you buy, 1 unit of carbon storage in the rainforest, and supposedly that's going to protect that rainforest. It's problematic for a number of reasons, including the country Papua New Guinea that's primarily promoting it, and which I've lived for many years, has a voracious illegal and legal rainforest logging industry going right now. So if they don't get a handle on that in the next 2 to 5 years, there's not going to be a lot of rainforests to be compensated. That's really going on around the world. Most large contiguous rainforests are threatened with deforestation, and about 30% of anthropocentric carbon emissions come from land cover changes, of which deforestation would be the most absolute. But selective logging actually plays a big role as well.
I just want to explain that word that you threw in there for folks who don't know it. Anthropocentric means human created.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, and there's other problematic issues with it, as well as whether the less developed countries should have to be relegated to sort of cleaning up our pollution. We drive our SUVs and then pay them to you know, forego development rights where they have aspirations like all people do to better themselves. So it would, you know, in concept, the idea of paying from carbon money, carbon market money, to pay people to protect the rainforest has tremendous potential. But we, let's not delude ourselves to think that it's an easy road or the only road. I mean, we absolutely need to cut emissions. We need to cut emissions by over a half. That's going to be a huge challenge when we dither even over the minor cuts. And renewable energy is not there yet. You know, some estimates show that things like wind and solar are really only going to be able to provide 30 to 40% of the energy mix, barring, you know, major, major advancements, just because of limits to their storage and how they could run. You could dispute that. But it's going to be a long, difficult road as well. And there is evidence that global ecosystems are fraying, that, you know, populations of animals are being affected and that humans are being affected. 150,000 people estimated a year to die directly related to climate change events. You know, we are witnessing, you know, this is a major point for me. Climate change is one aspect of the global ecological collapse that's going on. But it's really a broader malice of just too much consumption, requiring too many natural resources, which are more than can be replenished by the earth. And so you have the natural capital being diminished, if you will. And this cannot go on indefinitely. And I think we're going to have some rude awakenings in that regard, as far as I'm one of the peak oil people thinking, you know, this second half is going to be a lot harder of that oil supply.
I want to quote from the Sunday Los Angeles Times, which has an article regarding the Papua New Guinea suggestion regarding rainforest preservation compensation. This is what Daniel Becker, the Sierra Club's Global Warming and Energy Program Director, had to say regarding this proposal. Quote, "It's sort of the moral equivalent of hiring a domestic. We will pay you to clean our mess. For a long time here in America, we have believed in the polluter pays principle. This could be a pay to pollute principle." End quote. And that echoes several things that you had to say about this. You also, before we actually got on the air, and I'd forgotten about this, although I'd seen the article earlier in the week, Papua New Guinea is in the news last Friday. The Guardian out of London reports about part of an island is needing to be evacuated. And this is not the first time that this has happened in the Pacific, although I don't know that it has happened as far west in the Pacific as Papua New Guinea is. Can you shed any light on what's happening there with this issue?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Pacific Islands, many of the atolls are feet or meters above sea level and have always had problems with sea level surges. The countries of Tuvalu and Kiribati have already had some atolls, I believe, that are imminently threatened and in the process of being evacuated. And this story in Papua New Guinea, I believe it's pronounced Kartalet or Kartalay. This particular island, 1,000 people are being evacuated to the larger island of Bougainville. So, you know, for some proportion of the world's population, climate change means dramatic changes in their life, as it, you know, it has in New Orleans and many other places.
Okay, so we've hit about halfway here. I want to let folks know that they're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. Dr. Glenn Berry is my guest at the moment. We're talking kind of generally about some recent climate science and policy issues in connection with the Montreal United Nations Climate Change Conference going on. You can find out more about what Glenn works on by going to www.climatearc.org, CLIMATEARK.org. And from there, you can link to the several other sites that he operates. There's blogs, there's news, there's policy, there's solutions, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a really great resource for anyone interested in anything climate. So let's kind of shift gears and talk a little bit about Montreal. Now, as I mentioned at the front end, there's actually two different events going on. There's the Conference of the Parties, number 11, and that's the countries that signed the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in 1992. The United States did sign that. That's George H.R. Bush, H.W. Bush, at the time did sign that. And there were mandatory reductions in that agreement. 2001, George W. Bush, who occupies the White House still, said, "We're not participating in the Kyoto Protocol." The Kyoto Protocol was an outgrowth of the Framework Convention. And the second part of the Montreal meeting is the first meeting of the parties to the Kyoto Protocol. And the United States, as I mentioned again, is not allowed in that meeting except for observer status. And you know, all right, here, let me flip to a couple things because there's stuff in here that bears mentioning more than once. The meetings opened Monday. Harlan Watson is the U.S. lead delegate. He is a senior climate negotiator for the U.S. State Department. Now, before the event opened, and this seems just so typical of how the United States negotiates internationally. Before the official opening of the meeting, the United States lead delegate to the climate change conference said of future measures to combat climate change, these being post-Kyoto, quote, "We're going to resist it, obviously." Now, how does something like that impact the tone and the ability of other countries to negotiate in good faith, in your opinion, Glenn?
Well, it's just ridiculous. Never has the United States ever lagged further behind global consensus, nor really been as obstructionist as it is on the issue of climate change. You know, the history of the current President Bush is clear. There's no way that there's going to be an approval for mandatory restrictions upon carbon dioxide. It's interesting to see that the states imposing their own measures, and I've seen estimates that one-third of localities are now under some sort of limit similar to Kyoto. So, you know, the American government is quickly being left behind on this issue. But for this particular meeting, the pattern of obstructionism, of not negotiating in good faith, and really willfully turning their back on stunning science regarding the potential catastrophe to the global ecosystem, should we not immediately address climate change. So, you know, I think it's evil. I think the American position on climate change is evil and will doom the Bush presidency, along with the presidencies before it, but particularly this one, for just having utterly ignored reality as it was so clear that there had been and are fundamental changes in how the Earth operates happening before our eyes.
And as if Harlan Watson's statement about resisting any future measures to combat climate change was in any way unclear to people.
Exactly.
He further stated, and I'm quoting here from the Toronto Star yesterday, which has got some great coverage so far. Watson, quoting from the Toronto Star, Watson made it clear nothing substantial will come from the sessions in which he is involved. Now, in my mind, with a statement like that, I'm going to say, right, we're not including you. Unfortunately, the United States does happen to be the world's leading emitter of greenhouse gases. So there's this kind of pull and push thing where it's really, really important to have the United States government show not even leadership. I mean, at this point, I'd just be willing if they would stop obstructing and just go along. And, you know, okay, you don't want to have anything happen? We're not incorporating you, which you know, that's got to be a tough position again.
Yeah, well, there are a number of things. You know, I've always been sort of a reluctant Kyoto supporter. Reluctant because clearly the targets nowhere approximate a sufficient response to the magnitude of the crisis. We've gone through that. But at the same time, we're not going to get from zero to 60 overnight. And I always thought that Kyoto was important because it put in place mechanisms for mandatory emissions cuts. And then it would be fairly simple to tinker with the percentages as we, in the next decades, enter into, you know, former grain belts of major countries becoming desolate, arid lands, and those sorts of things that were aquifer water underneath many of these agricultural areas in China and the United States collapsing. But as those things happen, we can adjust the Kyoto. So I don't see any other games in town except Kyoto. And sure, it would be good to start from scratch, but that would take another 10 years. And so, you know, I think that really the approach is more towards individuals doing what they can and communities and really looking at your own life and trying to do the very simple things that you can to reduce your own emissions, the you know, fluorescent light bulbs and the weather stripping and even starting to look at renewable energy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really simple things that individuals can do because I was having a conversation with a housemate last night about this. Wasn't terribly up on the science and things along those lines. And I, you know, a lot of people aren't. Not everyone follows this stuff. And, you know, we were commenting on kind of the macro, why doesn't the United States government have some sort of involvement? And I said, well, keep in mind, you know, you're one of about 300 million individuals whose daily activities makes up what the United States emits. And each person reducing their own emissions, you know, not dropping them to zero. I mean, that's not feasible.
Do the best you can.
Do what you can. Do the simple stuff first. There's lots and lots of carbon emission reducing measures that are either profitable to do, especially if you're a homeowner, maybe not quite so much if you're a renter, and, you know, others that are not so much that they're profitable, but they kind of break even. You know, simple things. Pick a day of the week that you don't use your car when you ordinarily would. Swap out to lower energy use light bulbs. Maybe dial down how hot your hot water heater is. Maybe not have the heat at 70, drop it down to 67, drop it down to 55 at night. All really basic things that realistically everyone can do some ways. Any other good simple suggestions that folks listening might be able to just go, wow, I could do that?
I do think there are more midterm actions as well, and one of them is to live close to your work. It's you know, to be living in pedestrian friendly societies where you're able to walk to the grocery store and perhaps walk or take a short public transit to your work. That is a huge thing. Just the whole creation of the suburbs is deeply unecologically sustainable. And as you know, the energy crisis intensifies and climate change runs rampant, I think it's going to be important that people try to have some measure of self-sufficiency, of having a piece of land where you garden and matters to relocalize your life and relocalize economies towards what people can produce within a ready range of a particular city. There's going to be a lot more cities with hinterlands that are providing them, you know, kind of getting back to a yeoman, you know, sort of agricultural democracy, as mm-hmm. Jefferson spoke of. So that I very much sort of have that 70s back to the earth movement, although I know it's been discredited, but homesteading and growing your own vegetables and animal husbandry is a really good way to be more sustainable as well.
Now, with an eye towards moving along to my next guests in a few minutes here who are in Montreal at the talks, I want to throw something out that it's sort of the devil's advocate argument, and I'm reading here from an article written by a man named Warwick McKibben. Ever hear of him?
No.
Not surprising. He's a professorial fellow at the Lowy Institute for International Policy and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, though he operates out of, I guess he's Australian. And in an article he released today, he says that of the Kyoto Protocol, most of the signatory countries are not going to meet their goals. Or it sure seems like they're not going to. And emissions are rising. It's not just that the reductions aren't as big as hoped. Emissions are actually rising. And he says that there's a basic flaw in the approach followed at the international policy level so far by focusing on short-term targets and timetables. And he says this approach should be replaced with very long-term targets without precise timetables, because if you're operating on the context of 50, 100, 500 years, there's got to be some flexibility therein. And I'm just curious what you think about that idea. Have you heard of that idea before?
Well, there's all kinds of opinion on this. I don't believe that that approach is grounded in the science. We're looking at perhaps having a decade or two decades to significantly change the trend in carbon emissions. There's the old 2 degrees Celsius rule. There's some indication that that amount would be, beyond that would be dangerous climate change. We need to, mm-hmm. to keep this to a level that we can handle. And I don't think we have the luxury of relying solely on longer term broad goals that we don't know how we're going to get there. I think we need to pursue every avenue with as much haste as we can, because climate change is truly the event of our generation, and this really has the potential to threaten civilization and make large parts of the earth uninhabitable.
Yeah.
So and this meeting in Montreal is very important. There's things that need to happen there. They need to eventually get China and India on board. All nations need to be on board. They're going to need to tighten the rules. And this carbon trading still needs to be worked out to make sure that it's equitable as well. So there's important issues right now, but they need to be thinking about strict commitments to emissions reductions continuing past 2012. And the UN chief has said that might take a while, but that has to remain the goal.
And just this morning, the outgoing president of Britain's Royal Society, Lord May, compared the impact of climate change to the use of weapons of mass destruction, which garnered a whole lot of press when an advanced copy of his speech was released earlier this week. And so with that in mind, we're going to say goodbye to Dr. Glenn Berry. He is the president and founder of Ecological Internet, which runs many environmental web portals focusing on unique information retrieval tools and original analysis. Relevant to this show, you can go to climatearc.org, climatearc.org. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Glenn.
Yes, my pleasure, and I hope I'll be able to come back again.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye. And the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm has links to Glenn's sites, the UN conference site, many other sites related to the topic at hand. We're going for another half an hour here. We're going to feature a little bit of music here from Papua New Guinea. This is off the Guitar Bands of the 1990s CD from a compilation. And after that, we'll be back with Kurt Davies, Research Director of Greenpeace USA in Montreal. This track here is called Oh No! A little music there from Papua New Guinea called Oh No. That was the Kimuli String Band off a great compilation in the KBOO library called Bosavi, Rainforest Music from Papua New Guinea. It's a Smithsonian Folkways recording. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. We're going to continue on here with our discussion regarding global warming and climate change and the conferences happening in Montreal that opened Monday and go through December 9. For those of you just joining us, we had Dr. Glenn Berry from Ecological Internet, which runs climatearc.org, for the past half hour or so, talking generally about some new research, policy efforts, and other things related to climate change. And now I'm very happy to have for you from Montreal a couple of guests. We've got Kurt Davies, who is the research director from Greenpeace USA. Welcome to you, Kurt.
Thank you.
And also we have Maoshuang Li, who is a Chinese scientist also attending the talks. And welcome to you, Maoshuang.
Thank you.
Now, Kurt was good enough to organize your being here with us. So can you just first, Maoshuang, tell us a little bit about your background and what it is you're doing in Montreal so both myself and the listeners know?
I've been doing research and also a project on climate change impacts on China's mother river, the Yellow River Salts region, which is located on the Tibetan Plateau. And I arrived on November 28th together with the whole Greenpeace delegation in Montreal.
Okay, great. So you work with Greenpeace?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So, Kurt, we talked a little bit with Glenn earlier about some of the statements that Harlan Watson made not only during the first couple days of the conference, but actually before the thing even opened, about how the United States not only didn't want to do anything in terms of binding agreements, it wanted to prevent other countries from doing so, and that it was going to obstruct and prevent any action from coming out of any talks it participated in. How has that gone over with the folks you're talking with up there in Montreal?
Well, you know, it has two sets of impacts. One, it's so negative and so belligerent that it's like a rat trapped in the corner, and it gets very angry and upset and mean, and it turns meaner as you try to kill it. And Harlan's statements both invigorate the meeting because other parties hopefully take the lead, because the U.S. is not obviously leading. And then it also takes the wind out of some sails, because it shows that the biggest polluter on Earth is not willing to party here and not willing to negotiate. In fact, if they're coming to the negotiations and saying, we're not willing to agree to anything, then it changes the whole tone of the debate.
Now, is that what you've heard from delegates, or is this from other NGOs, or it's kind of across the board?
It's a general sense. I mean, they had a press conference here yesterday. They, in fact, threw out one journalist from Germany who apparently was asking questions that were too hard to answer. And it's sort of polling the pulse of the meeting. People are not intimidated by the U.S. here, but the U.S. is an enormous player in global warming, and there are some parties who would like to include them at any cost. And we are trying to encourage them that they should forget about the U.S., the federal government, and not wait for the U.S. to establish a new goal of cutting pollution, but in fact that local efforts in the U.S. are very promising. The states and cities and community efforts, like you have in Portland, like you have in Seattle, the mayor of Seattle has organized all these other mayors to do Kyoto targets. So it's happening, but without Bush, is essentially our message.
Now, Maoshuang, can you tell us a little bit more in detail about what the research you're doing on the Yellow River, what you've found as a result of this research?
Sure. Under climate change, the Yellow River source is experiencing an environmental crisis. And actually, all the environmental elements are being affected. During the last 50 years, the whole Tibetan plateau, especially the Yellow River source, has seen a very sharp temperature rise of nearly 1 degree, and that has caused glaciers to retreat on a large scale. Now it's retreating 10 times faster than 300 years ago. Also, there is the thawing of permafrost, and also shrinking of lakes and wetlands, grassland degradation and desertification. In one word, the whole Yellow River source region is undergoing a kind of, as I said, environmental crisis because of climate change, and that has also a very broad social impact there.
Well, how is it impacting the people who live in the headwaters region of the Yellow River? Are they having reduced access to fresh water?
Mm-hmm. They suffered from... It's actually ridiculous that they live in the source region of the Yellow River, but they have difficulty to access drinking water, especially in wintertime for the herdsmen. And according to statistics, there are already 3,000 households of herdsmen, together with their 120,000 cattle, who couldn't have drinking water in wintertime. And in that whole region, because the temperature is rising so fast and permafrost melting, that has caused the grassland to deteriorate, and the desertified area in Yellow River Source region is already above one-third of the total area of that region. So that has led to the direct impoverishment of the local herdsmen, and right now there are already above 50,000 environmental refugees in that region.
The talks have two components, as mentioned. The more important, I suppose, is the actual first meeting of the parties to the Kyoto Protocol. That's for signatory countries only. The U.S. and Australia are the only industrialized countries not able to attend as anything but observer. Obviously, a huge issue in these talks, which are focused on dealing with the post-Kyoto time frame of after 2012, as well as implementing properly until then, but a huge issue is the countries of India and China, and including them in any future talks. You are participating in some of these kind of as a lobbyist and informal basis, Kurt. Can you tell us a little bit about how this issue is being approached, and how receptive are the delegations from India and China in terms of making some sort of binding commitment for the future?
Well, first, the misunderstanding that is portrayed by the Bush administration is that those countries have never intended to take any action to do anything under climate change, and that is just a myth and a lie, and they play it to great advantage with conservatives in Congress to make us believe that the U.S. is doing this alone somehow, and that because India and China are not bound by the treaty, that's not fair. In fact, the way the treaty was set up, the largest polluters should act first, right? The richer countries should take action first and then help with technology, clean technology transfer to the poorer countries and allow them to make a transition. So, in fact, there's a lot of action going on in China and in India to be part of the treaty, to create clean energy projects and pollution reduction projects. And as far as I have heard, they are open to discussion of how to shape a commitment under the treaty and to move into a more active status in the treaty. I don't know, Maoshuang, can you fill in on that?
Yeah, do you have anything to add to that, Maoshuang, about in specific China's receptivity to a future binding agreement about CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions?
China is still a developing country, and it doesn't have the historical responsibility for the emission of greenhouse gas. But right now, China is a developing country. I mean, its industry is booming, and the greenhouse gas emission from China cannot really be ignored. So actually, what China is doing now is and it is participating actively in the CDM, so-called the Clean Energy Mechanism Project, and China has shown great interest in developing that, and China has already actually got one registered with the EB Executive Board of CDM, and that is a renewable energy, actually a wind farm project in Xinjiang province. And actually this year, in February, China has passed her first renewable energy law, and that provides a very favorable policy framework for China's future development in renewable energy.
Can you tell us a little bit about that renewable energy law passed earlier this year?
That law has actually a fixed price for renewable energy, and that is a very good mirror to encourage investors to invest in that.
Okay.
And that fixed price is relatively high, but I mean, in that way, it encourages investment.
Now, both of you have mentioned the clean development mechanism, and a couple hours ago when we spoke, Kurt, you said the CDM talks were just getting underway. Can you explain a little bit for folks who don't know what it is, what the clean development mechanism is, what it's supposed to do, and what is it they're talking about in Montreal about it?
The clean development mechanism is a creative part of the Kyoto Protocol that is intended to drive clean technology into developing economies and help to leapfrog the dirty pathway that we've taken in this country, for example. So they could skip the dirty industrial revolution and go straight to the clean energy revolution. That's in theory. Of course, there are loopholes to be found by anyone. And for example, right now there are several projects that result in enormous credits that don't cost anything and don't actually should not be credited for destroying a waste product of producing refrigerant gases that go into refrigerators. But anyway, this is potentially the biggest positive effect of the Kyoto Protocol is to drive investment and your corporations involved and governments involved, drive investment in renewable energy, in energy efficiency, in cleaning up old power plants and doing anything we can to cut greenhouse gases in developing economies.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. We're speaking with Kurt Davies, Greenpeace USA Research Director, and Maoshuang Li, who works with Greenpeace as a researcher in China. Maoshuang, you had mentioned you might have a time conflict. Do we need to say goodbye, or do you have another 10 minutes with us?
I guess I have to go now.
Okay, well, I really appreciate you being available to talk to us a little bit about what you've been working on in China, and to the extent possible, enjoy your time in Montreal.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for being with us, and we're going to have Kurt stick around. Lord May, outgoing president of the British Royal Society, made what I consider to be completely appropriate remarks comparing the lack of activity regarding climate change emissions, reducing climate change emissions, to the impact of weapons of mass destruction. How has that rhetoric gone over in Montreal?
I haven't seen that repeated here, but it's an appropriate comparison on some levels because effectively these are pollution that travels around the world that has an impact everywhere and disproportionately a hard impact in developing countries. The World Health Organization was recently published in a scientific journal has estimated that there are already 150,000 people who die a year from health impacts like drought and insect-borne disease that has been exacerbated, made worse by global warming. So that's 150,000 dead a year already, and those estimates go much higher when you project out the global warming that is coming in the next few decades and in this century. So it's a very serious matter indeed.
Now, the Kyoto Protocol is the only international binding agreement regarding reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is kind of the parent body of the Kyoto Protocol.
Yeah, the umbrella. The
UNFCCC released a publication recently called Key Greenhouse Gas Data, and it's basically all the greenhouse gas data officially submitted by all the countries in connection with joining the Kyoto Protocol. That data shows that not only are countries, by and large, going to miss hitting their targets, but emissions are actually rising again, as opposed to a smaller level of reduction.
Right.
So given this, and that Kyoto's only average about 5.2% reduction on emissions from 1990 levels by 2012, and that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change years ago said 5%, we need like 60% minimum now. How do you get from not being able to achieve a 5% reduction to being able to credibly discuss what the leading scientists around the world are saying is necessary in terms of the atmospheric science? How do you get from not hitting 5 to talking about 60 or 80?
Yeah, exactly. That's the puzzle. I mean, they've made a beautiful coffee table book out of those numbers, by the way, if you want one. The story is this: global warming is like is a problem we caught late, and we have taken a long time to try to solve, and we're slow. It's like we've driven the truck off the bridge, and now we're discussing the possibility of inventing brakes, and that might be a good idea. But that doesn't mean it's too late. It's approaching too late to solve some of the impacts, but everything helps, right? So the discussion actually on the table here, as you said in the opener, is that what we do after the Kyoto Promise, which was made in 1997, which entails a commitment period, they call it, between 2008 and 2012, the next commitment period, the parties are required to respond to the science and assess the adequacy of their commitments. That's words from the treaty. So they have to see, are we doing enough to solve this problem? In the case of the ozone layer, when that treaty, which is very similar in form to this treaty, the science became fairly overwhelming within a few years of discovery of the ozone hole, and the parties acted faster and faster to cut out the ozone-depleting chemicals, the air pollution that was causing that. So we hope that this accelerates the urgency, the science. The interplay between the science and the policy here is what's so important. And the science, since the last big assessment report by the IPCC you mentioned, has been overwhelming. There's more and more evidence. The last report said, yes, there is a human footprint. Now it's more like a giant footprint. It's much faster than they thought it was going to be, a lot of these changes that are taking place. So it certainly will... The science certainly lends an urgency to the debate here.
In closing here, I'm curious what it is that you hope you can help accomplish. I've seen statements from British delegation representatives saying, yeah, we're not going to be able to do anything here. The Australian delegation was similarly optimistic. The U.S. has said nothing's going to happen if we have anything to say about it. And yet there's voices from countries that most people probably couldn't find on a map. Many of the small island nations in the Pacific who, some said this is genocide years and years ago. So I'm curious, what do you think's going to come out of Montreal?
Well, we don't give up. And Greenpeace has been working on this for a very long time. And the entire environmental community here works very hard, long hours, to hold these folks accountable. If we weren't in the room, I think the delegates would all be sitting back drinking coffee and going home 2 weeks later. But we've seen time and time again that as we apply pressure and ratchet up that pressure over the two-week meeting, that eventually they get down to business. And daily we hold them accountable with a magazine called Eco that you can find on the web on climatenetwork.org. And you can see what's going on. We give out a Fossil of the Day award to the worst actor, so we shame them when they go bad. And we have actually some hope that we can pull something out of the fire here and get an agreement out of Montreal.
Kurt Davies is the research director for Greenpeace USA. You can find out more about them online at greenpeaceusa.org, and peace is P-E-A-C-E. Thank you very much for joining us from Montreal, Kurt.
Thanks a lot.
All right, take care.
Bye.
And we're going to close out the program here with a little bit of audio that I found this morning just preceding the Montreal UN Climate Change Conference. There was an international youth summit, and here you're going to be listening to Matthew Carroll. He is the Youth Caucus Coordinator of the United Nations Commission on Sustainable Development. He works with an organization called Rising Tide, and he is also an organizer with the Youth Launch Party. And he's from Britain, which is why you may not have ever heard of the Youth Launch Party. And I'll be back in just a minute or so.
Today we had the launch of the entire youth presence in Montreal. It was called At What Cost? And it was the culmination of a groundbreaking international youth summit that's been taking place over the last 5 days. There have been 90 young people from all around the world come together to create a declaration all about their opinions on climate change and what we can do about it. So the event was the launch of that declaration. It was also an opportunity to provide some really fascinating experiences and viewpoints from young people that are really well-versed in the issue of climate justice, which is one of the key messages coming out of the declaration, that we need to build solutions to climate change that are based on climate justice and as part of a world that's free from oppression. For me at least, and I think for a lot of the young people that are here in Montreal, we recognise that climate change isn't just an environmental issue. It's at its fundamental core, it's about social justice. It's about the communities that are being most impacted at the moment by climate change are those who've been historically oppressed the most by oil extraction and will feel the burden of the effects of climate change. And we have to try to work to ensure that the voices of those communities are heard, they speak for themselves, and that they really lead the way within our movement. I think that's really vital.
That's Matthew Carroll speaking from the International Youth Summit that preceded the Montreal UN climate change talks. He's the Youth Caucus Coordinator of the United Nations Commission on Sustainable Development. And here is some text from the International Youth Declaration released following that summit. This is available at www.itsgettinghotinhere.org. We, the youth of today and leaders of tomorrow, face an unprecedented challenge as a result of global climate change and share in the responsibility of addressing it. Taking a step back from the complexities of compromise and negotiation, we cannot help but think the purpose of the convention has been sidelined. We are frightened by the scale of this emerging global environmental crisis. We stand in solidarity with vulnerable communities who are disproportionately impacted by climate change, including low-income people, marginalized groups, indigenous peoples, and people living in geographically vulnerable areas. As stewards of the Earth, we demand the right for all future generations to inherit a healthy planet. And now, from their actual declaration, and pardon me if I'm a little hesitant here because the way this thing printed, it's extremely tiny. Okay, regarding their commitments, youth around the world are committed to protecting the climate. We engage our communities in participatory action and encourage the respect of humanity's place in nature, cultural diversity, indigenous rights, and traditional knowledge. And now skipping down to some of the demands, we call for a permanent funded youth constituency to be included in the international climate change negotiation process by COP12, which would be the UN meeting after this one in Montreal. We need minimum binding emissions reduction targets of 30% by 2020 and 80% by 2050 for, quote, developed, unquote, countries. Flexible mechanisms must supplement, not substitute, domestic emissions reductions. We ask governments for a just transition to low-impact renewable energy and insist on the removal of all fossil fuel subsidies. Food and water security must be guaranteed. incorporate an ambitious multidisciplinary approach to sustainable development in our education systems, including curriculum on climate change. And then they have more text regarding their vision. The rest of this document is available at www.itsgettinghotinhere.org. I'd like to thank all the guests we had on today, Dr. Glenn Berry from ClimateArc.org, Kurt Davies from Greenpeace USA, and Maoshuang Li from Greenpeace China. You can send email to me about anything you heard today or any other day at kboo@riseup.net. The People Rise Up website at kboo.fm has links to lots and lots of information related to climate change, global warming, the Montreal Conference, and a whole bunch of other stuff that I'm not even sure what it is yet, because the site's not totally complete. I really appreciate your listening, and you can find an archive copy of this show at radioforall.net. You can search for my name, Andrew Geller.